Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into a case study that, on the surface, involves one of Canada's most picturesque provinces.
Right.
But, you know, beneath that beauty and the tourism veneer, there is a serious fiscal crisis brewing. We are talking about Prince Edward Island.
That's exactly right. For so many people, PEI means red cliffs, quiet living, maybe Anne of Green Gables.
Sure.
But if you're watching provincial finances, it represents a real cautionary tale about rapid, unsustainable debt growth.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward. We're pulling key analyses from sources like the Auditor General, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, and the Fraser Institute to really understand the island's economic future.
And the headline is, it's immediate and it's alarming.
It really is. This isn't just a slow creep of debt.
No, it's an explosion. Over the last 10 years, PEI's provincial debt has increased by approximately 100%.
A doubling.
A full doubling. And you have to think about that context. I mean, you look at provinces like Alberta or British Columbia, they have massive resource revenues, huge global trading hubs, you know, to cushion the blow of spending.
Right, they have a buffer.
PEI just doesn't have that structural advantage. It's an island economy. It's heavily reliant on agriculture, tourism, small business. So when that debt doubles, it rests almost entirely on the shoulders of individual islanders and their small companies.
And this is something we need to internalize right from the start, what all the analysts call delayed taxation.
Yes.
This debt, it isn't free money. It is a bill that must be paid later.
It's absolutely critical we all recognize that. I mean, when a politician decides to spend money today without taxing for it today, they are essentially just issuing a future tax bill. And for PEI, that bill is growing at a rate that is simply unsustainable for its size.
And it's not just a small increase.
No, the debt per capita isn't just increasing marginally. It's accelerating by double digits year after year.
Okay, so let's establish the raw scale of this liability. Because if you look back to, say, the 2018-2019 fiscal year, the total debt for the province was around $2.2 billion.
Which is still a lot, but manageable.
Manageable, right.
But then you fast forward just a few years. By the end of this current fiscal year, that figure is projected to exceed $3.56 billion.
Wow.
That's an increase of nearly 68% in an incredibly short time frame. And here's the core structural red flag. The overall debt load now exceeds their annual government revenues.
They owe more than they take in over a whole year.
That's it.
And if we translate that financial liability directly onto the residents, the numbers become even more real, right? Back in 2018-2019, the per capita debt was sitting at roughly $13,950.
A heavy load for sure. But now, it has ballooned to $19,500 per person today.
For every man, woman, and child.
Exactly. This isn't abstract math. This is a liability on every single person living on the island. And it fundamentally restricts what future governments can do for essential services.
So what are the professionals saying about this? I mean, when the numbers accelerate that fast, you inevitably get loud warnings from the watchdogs.
You do. And the Auditor General, Darren Noonan, has been very, very direct. He's flagged the island's fiscal position as increasingly fragile.
Fragile is a strong word.
It is, and he chose it carefully. It implies that the system isn't just stressed. It's vulnerable to any kind of sudden external shock. His main concerns are around overspending, a demonstrable lack of effective fiscal controls, and most importantly, a heavy, unhealthy reliance on federal transfers to just plug the holes in the operating budget.
And that fragility, it gets amplified by specific policy decisions from the last few years. We know external groups like the CTF and the Fraser Institute, they point out that debt is outpacing population and economic growth.
Right, driven by public sector cost overruns.
But there was also that crucial decision made by Premier Dennis King about immigration.
That decision was huge. To restrict the volume of immigration a few years ago had a very clear, measurable negative impact. It restricted the input of three specific types of capital that a small economy desperately needs to thrive.
Okay, let's break that down. What are they?
Human capital, investment capital, and knowledge capital.
So human capital is the people, the workers, the consumers.
Exactly. Investment capital is the money they bring with them to buy homes or start businesses.
And knowledge capital would be the specialized skills, the new ideas.
You got it. So when you intentionally slow the intake of new residents and all the capital they bring, you slow the entire engine of the economy. The tax base shrinks relative to the demands on services, making the government even more dependent on borrowing or federal handouts.
So it's a policy decision that directly accelerated their fiscal reliance on Ottawa.
It's a perfect storm. You erode the base, now you have to borrow more.
That sets the stage perfectly for this core idea, the connection between debt and the tax system. If debt is delayed taxation, when do Islanders finally pay the piper?
Well, they're already paying it. And the analysts are really clear on the long-term consequences. They're saying expect higher taxes, expect cuts to essential services, roads, schools, healthcare, and expect reduced private sector investment because the environment just becomes less and less competitive.
Let's focus on that competitiveness because this is where the listener, you know, regardless of where you live, needs to pay attention to the specific numbers. It speaks volumes about the business climate.
It really does.
If I'm a rational investor looking at starting a business or moving my skills somewhere in Canada, I'm absolutely looking at the tax burden.
And this is where the Fraser Institute's analysis, particularly from Ben Eisen, provides that shocking aha moment. We need to compare PEI's personal income tax burden to places like Ontario and Alberta provinces, often seen as economically favorable.
Okay, let's do it. Let's take a middle-class income, say $50,000. In PEI, the combined marginal tax rate is 13.47%.
Which is already the third highest in the country.
Right. Now, contrast that with Ontario. For that exact same $50,000 income, the marginal rate is just 5.05%.
The difference is staggering. I mean, it's almost three times higher in PEI. That is a massive deterrent to attracting and retaining skilled professionals, entrepreneurs, anyone who can move freely. Why would you choose to locate your job in PEI when you can keep so much more of your income somewhere else?
And the situation actually gets worse as the income goes up, doesn't it?
It does. At an income of $75,000, PEI's rate climbs to 16.67%. And according to the sources, that is the highest marginal rate in the entire country at that income level.
Highest in the country.
The highest.
And if you push up to $100,000, PEI leads again at 17.5%. And you compare that to Alberta at 10% or Ontario at just under 11%.
Yeah.
The personal income tax rates are just structurally uncompetitive.
And this isn't just bad luck. It's a specific structural flaw that governments have actively chosen not to fix. PEI holds the unique and, frankly, unenviable distinction of being the only province in Canada that does not index its tax brackets to inflation.
I think we need to linger on that because non-indexation sounds technical, but it's basically a hidden tax increase every single year.
It is a stealth tax. That's the perfect term for it. Every year, as inflation pushes your wages up just slightly, you're automatically pushed into higher tax brackets, even if your real purchasing power hasn't increased at all.
So the government gets more tax revenue just by doing nothing.
By doing nothing. It's a reform that local chambers of commerce have consistently begged for because it impacts every single working Islander. It just erodes what little competitiveness their tax system had left.
So we have ballooning debt, rising costs, a highly uncompetitive tax environment. What is the forecast for the next few years? I mean, is there a path back to fiscal stability being laid out by the current government?
Unfortunately, no. The sources show the government has presented a fiscal plan that actually projects adding debt for the next three consecutive years.
So they're actively choosing to increase the delayed taxation.
That's the plan.
So what will the total liability look like if this trajectory holds?
By the 2027-2028 fiscal year, the total debt is forecasted to hit a very sobering $4.23 billion.
Wow.
And that per-person liability we talked about will rise even further to $22,300. That is the weight being placed on the shoulders of the next generation.
And the immediate non-negotiable consequence of carrying that much debt is the servicing cost, the interest payments.
Yep.
How much of the island's economic output is just disappearing into the void of interest payments?
It's a frightening drain on the GDP. The sources indicate that by 2025-2026, 5.1% of PEI's gross domestic product will be dedicated purely to debt servicing.
So more than 5 cents out of every dollar earned on the island.
Go straight to bondholders and banks. Not into schools, not into roads, and certainly not into their desperately needed healthcare system.
And you just lost money. And that servicing cost is forecast to grow, right?
Absolutely. By 2027-2028, it's projected to reach 6.5% of GDP. This is the structural consequence. Continuous deficit spending severely limits the capital you have available for necessary public investment.
This escalating cost brings us right back to Auditor General Noonan's major warning about the loss of policy flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Listener, why should you care if your provincial government loses policy flexibility? What does that practically mean for your everyday life?
It means that you cannot decide your own priorities. It's that simple. If your operating budget is structured to require constant federal transfers just to avoid insolvency, you are essentially asking Ottawa for permission to run your province.
So if Islanders decide they desperately need a new regional hospital or a dedicated initiative to combat a local health crisis, they don't have the financial autonomy to just fund it themselves.
Precisely. They become beholden to federal priorities, federal timelines, federal funding formulas. Losing policy flexibility means you cannot pivot quickly to address local needs. You can't innovate on specific island issues. You cannot chart a truly local course for your own economy.
That's the real cost.
That is the real existential cost of chronic debt and dependency.
And that dependency feels especially fragile right now. You look at the ongoing national debate about the fiscal imbalance. Provinces with large economies, like Alberta, are increasingly questioning the sheer volume of money being transferred to other jurisdictions. That financial lifeline PEI depends on is not guaranteed forever.
And that's exactly why the experts are calling for fiscal courage. This isn't just about saving money anymore. It's about restoring autonomy and resilience. The sources outline a pretty clear business-minded approach needed to reverse this course.
What's step one in that strategy?
Step one is simple, but it's politically very challenging. Restore spending discipline. Governments have to operate with the same prudence you'd expect of any successful business or even just a regular household.
You have to spend within your means.
You have to. And that requires making difficult decisions about which programs are truly essential and which are merely desirable.
And the second pillar shifts focus from the quantity of spending to the quality, correct?
Yes, that is prioritizing outcomes. Funding should follow demonstrable results and performance, not just political optics. We have seen time and again governments funding projects or building infrastructure based on a press release.
Sure, for the photo op.
For the photo op, rather than genuine long-term operational sustainability. I mean, if you build a beautiful facility that you cannot afford to staff or operate, you have simply converted cash into debt without creating any lasting value.
And the third point goes directly to governance fixing the system itself.
That's strengthening financial controls. The Auditor General consistently flags issues in the administration. These are systemic flaws that lead to waste and overruns. When those flaws are pointed out, the administration has to fix the underlying problem immediately, not just offer up political excuses.
It's a failure of public trust if they don't.
It's a fundamental failure of governance, and it contributes directly to this debt spiral.
And the final pillar seems to be the one that binds the whole strategy together.
Yeah.
Reversing that dependency trend.
Absolutely. Rebuild autonomy. This means structurally reducing the dependence on federal transfers. It's about creating a tax base and an economic environment that is strong enough to fund provincial operations locally without having to wait for the next check from Ottawa. This is the only way to ensure local governance truly means local control.
But has this kind of approach ever actually worked in PEI before? I mean, when you look back, has there ever been a time when the island successfully implemented this kind of fiscal restraint?
Yes, there has. And that's what proves that political will, not economic impossibility, is the missing ingredient today. We have historical precedents.
Like what?
Well, the government of Pat Binns successfully balanced the budget multiple times between 1997 and 2006. More recently, Wade McLaughlin managed a small surplus in 2018-2019.
And even the current premier, Dennis King, balanced the budget in 2022-2023.
He did.
But as we established, debt has absolutely exploded since that small surplus.
Precisely. Those historical examples show that periods of discipline are possible. The current explosion of debt shows that the structural shift required to maintain that discipline just hasn't been made. That recent balanced budget was a temporary dip in the trajectory, not a sustained change in philosophy.
So if you are looking at the island's economic landscape today, what's the core takeaway you should be tracking?
The core takeaway is that PEI's debt growth is rapidly undermining its entire competitive position. The combination of accelerating debt, the massive cost of servicing it, and those crushing non-index tax rates. It's creating an economy that actively drives away capital, both human and financial.
So continued overspending limits the opportunities for the next generation of Islanders.
Who will inherit this $22,000 bill per person?
This isn't just an internal island issue, though. It really is a signal for anyone investing anywhere in Canada that fiscal prudence matters. If you feel, having seen this data, that the priority must shift back to fiscal responsibility, the sources suggest that democratic action making your voice heard is essential now before the situation becomes irreparable.
And that leads us to our final thought to mull over. Given that the government is projecting debt growth for the next 3 years, potentially reaching over $4.2 billion, we have to ask, what is the true cost of losing policy flexibility when you're facing unforeseen future crises? How many more years of planned debt growth before PEI crosses the point of no return on its economic independence, becoming in effect a ward of the federal government, unable to chart its own course? That loss of autonomy is the ultimate price of delayed taxation.